Well, good morning, TNC family. On this second Sunday in March, 3 weeks until Easter, we're here. I want to consider with you over these next 3 weeks, three essential questions surrounding Easter. First, its historicity. Did it even happen, somebody dying and being resurrected in history? Because that can feel far-fetched and mythical. And so we're going to think about that today. And then next week, the question is, what's up with the cross? What happened there? I mean, tens of thousands of folks were crucified in that era. So what makes Jesus of Nazareth's crucifixion different? Why do biblical authors say that the cross, and not the resurrection, the cross was the power of God, 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And that on the cross, Colossians 2, he disarmed the principalities and powers and made a public example of them, triumphing over them on the cross. What's up with the cross? And then week 3, how does it, how should it, how might it, how can Easter change my life today? But first, let's talk about, did the resurrection really happen? Because Paul writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 14 that if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is useless and your faith is in vain. And I'll tell you what else happens often around this question. Christians are afraid of it. That if they talk about it, if they examine the evidence, well, it might confuse them or hurt their faith or get them into arguments they can't support. I'd rather not think about it, David. I'll just claim it and believe it in faith, they say. And of course, this is of no help to the person actually wrestling with the claim that does feel like on the surface far-fetched, anti-science, impossible to prove, and certainly it's against the norm. I mean, people don't die and come back to bodily life 3 days later. And some folks will say, this is just not the kind of thing you can prove historically. Which is exactly the comment that leads us into what we're going to talk about today, which is how evidence works, which is the nature of proof when it comes to history. Because that word prove means different things in different disciplines. For example, in mathematics, we actually do have proofs, things that are always true all the time. Math is why we can land a spacecraft on the moon or know the area of a triangle and on and on. But in science, we don't have proofs. Nothing is proven. We only have theories and hypotheses. And so now when it comes to history, just know you don't and can't have mathematical type proofs. That's simply not actually how proofs work with historical inquiry. In history, something can be proven in the sense of, if you have good historical evidence for a conclusion, to make it more probable than not. In history, what you do is you look at all the evidence for something, and then you make what is called an inference to the best explanation. An inference to the best explanation. Now, this is what I want to do now with the resurrection, and I want to explain to you first how a person can look at what they do know and make assumptions and inferences to what they don't yet know or can't know for sure. And I want to do this with a thought experiment, okay? So imagine you have a niece or a nephew or a grandchild spending a long weekend with you, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and imagine that he's 6 years old and his name is Joey. And you have a box of double stuffed Oreo cookies in your pantry that you just bought them on Saturday. But on Saturday night, unbeknownst to you, Joey goes into the pantry, eats the entire box of cookies, but then tiptoes to the front door, opens it, walks out, and drops the empty box in the neighbor's trash bin so you can't find it, and then little Joey goes to bed. Now, thought experiment. Imagine that early Sunday morning, you wake up, you open the pantry, and you notice the Oreos are gone. And you wonder, what happened to the Oreos? You think, maybe I left them in the cart at the grocery store. Never brought them home. Maybe I left them in the trunk in the car. Maybe I absentmindedly put them in the refrigerator or in the laundry basket by accident. Or maybe I didn't buy him at all. I just thought I bought him. And about that time, little Joey wakes up and comes downstairs. And you can't make this up. He has what appears to be chocolate cookies between all of his teeth and some crumbs on his pajamas. And Joey says, I have a stomach ache. And so you ask him, well, Joey, did you eat the Oreos last night? And Joey doesn't want to get in trouble. So Joey says, no. And you pause and you review the evidence again and you ask. And Joey says, no, I promise, I didn't. And the truth is, you can't find the box anywhere. And you aren't going to take him to the doctors to get his stomach pumped and the contents chemically analyzed. And your spouse also really likes Oreo cookies. So maybe it was your spouse who ate them. Or maybe somebody broke into your house overnight and took only the cookies. And maybe the black in Joey's teeth is from the black beans in the leftover container in the refrigerator. See, turns out you can't prove that little Joey ate the cookies. But what you can do is you can look at the evidence and you can make an inference to the best explanation. And in that sense, historically speaking, I think it can be proven. And TNC, we do this all the time with history, with discoveries, with information. I was outside exercising on a walk the other day, and I glanced down and I saw, and then I picked up what appeared to be a coin. Only the coin was larger than a dime, smaller than a nickel, yet it was not the color of a copper penny. It was like steel gray. And on one side, it was covered in dirt, so I couldn't see anything on the backside. And on the front side, because of my age and my eyes, I couldn't read a date or anything. At which point, now think about it, assuming it was a coin, don't laugh, assuming it was a coin, it could have been a coin from ancient Rome or Greece, or a coin from the Ming Dynasty in China, or the Aztec Empire in Mexico. And in that moment, you couldn't prove to me one way or the other. Although, I did begin to make inferences to the best explanation based on the evidence I did have, which is, I did find it in Atlanta, Georgia, which pointed me in the direction of U.S. currency. Further, and now this was a big hint, it had Abraham Lincoln's face on it, or at least, because I've never met Lincoln, at least engravings in the shape of the person I was taught as a kid was the face of Abe Lincoln, which narrowed down the time frame considerably. I mean, he wasn't even born until 1809, was not president until 1861, so it couldn't be ancient coin. And then I did remember in that moment something about how there was a time, a year, or an era, or something, when pennies were made out of used steel ammunition shells that were used for training U.S. military soldiers. For I think it was World War II, in order to conserve copper for the war effort. Inference to the best explanation, it's a penny from the 1940s. And so when I got home, I rinsed off the dirt, then took a close-up picture of it with my phone, and then expanded it even more, saw the date, 1943. Then I went online, looked it up. Sure enough, 1943, U.S. struck the steel penny. And so I kept this penny. I keep it in a drawer in my house. And yes, I guess it still could be a forgery, because I haven't had a numismatist look at it. But I'm telling you, inference to the best explanation, it is a 1943 steel penny. Okay, similarly, as we approach Easter, we should be happy to ask, even though we can't know mathematically for sure that Jesus rose from the grave, what do we know? What can we know? And what is the inference we can make from it to the best explanation? Which leads me now to some things we can know that will help us get to the best explanation surrounding the question of Easter. And I'm going to do just quick bullet points here that will hopefully lead to continuing exploration and study and conversation. But here we go as we try to make an inference to the best explanation. Number one, if our expanding universe had a beginning, if an intelligent designer brought all space, time, matter, and energy into existence out of nothing, then breathing back in the breath of life into an already existing body is entirely plausible. So, did our universe have a beginning? Well, it's not even a question much anymore. Everybody understands, yes, it did. Read, study your science about cosmic microwave background radiation and recession of galaxies in the expanding universe, the work of George Lemaître, Edwin Hubble. Follow current peer-reviewed leading thinkers in cosmology, physics, science generally. Philip Goff, Stephen Meyer, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Deborah Harsma, Roger Penrose, Dean Hastings, Francis Collins, and on. Kazmika Corbet, Catherine Blundell, Brian Greene, read about wormholes, black holes, 11 dimensions of existence, parallel universes, quantum theory, and you'll see science is overwhelming in its support for first, in the words of Einstein, spooky stuff happening, second, our universe's beginning, and third, its fine-tuning. Follow the new information coming from the James Webb Space Telescope. It's fascinating. But it's just continuing to confirm this. The universe had a beginning. So first point, if the universe came into existence from nothing, and or God exists, the resurrection is infinitely easy, generally speaking. Number two, Jesus was a person. In fact, there's not a single serious historian in the entire academic world who doesn't believe that Jesus was an actual person who, number three, lived in the 20s and 30s common era in the region of Galilee and Judea, who, number four, was a Jewish religious figure making claims about messiahship, and who, number five, died on a Roman cross, was crucified. TNC, listen, no serious person alive rejects these things. And remember, we are seeking inference to the best explanation. Which leads to this, something you may not have thought a lot about, but which is key to the likelihood of resurrection. Number six, Jesus was buried in a tomb. We have at least five independent sources that support the burial account, and it's noteworthy that the burial of Jesus was by a member of the Sanhedrin, Joseph of Arimathea. He was not buried by his beloved disciples. Plus, archaeological evidence of burial in the Roman era supports that crucified people were buried. Plus, Roman legal material explicitly states that the bodies of the executed, if request is made, can be taken down and given proper burial. Plus, the bodies of the crucified during peacetime, were not only permitted to be buried, but were expected to be buried before sundown on the day of death. Plus, Jewish authorities would have wanted Jesus' body taken down from the cross before nightfall. It was Passover, and there was an understood defilement of the land of the dead body. Burial is simply what they did. Jesus was buried. And this is important, and virtually all New Testament scholars agree that it is more likely than not that Jesus would have been buried. Which leads to number seven, but the tomb was discovered to be empty on Sunday morning. First by women, then men, by disciples and doubters, by Jewish and Roman authorities. And by the way, doubters of the claims of Jesus' resurrection could have gone to the tomb because the tomb was there and folks would have gone and checked it out. It would have been one of the first things they did upon hearing that Jesus was risen. And the site of the burial would have been known to Jews and Christians alike. And the disciples would never have had credibility to the resurrection if the tomb wasn't empty. But the tomb was empty. Number eight, and the discovery of the empty tomb is not first presented by Jesus' biographers as evidence for the resurrection, but rather as a mystery in search of a solution. Read the stories. The empty tomb brings about fear and unrest and the absence of hope, not, aha, yes, I get it now. That confidence would come later after re-studying and re-examining the scriptures. But first, Luke 24:11, they did not believe the women because their words seemed to them like nonsense. John 20, but Thomas said to them, fine, the tomb's empty, but unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. Which leads to number nine, Remember, we're after inference to the best explanation. Number 9, and scholars universally agree on this, Christian and non-Christian alike, the first Christians claimed not just that the tomb was empty, but to have seen Jesus after his death and burial. In fact, there was a diverse and large group of witnesses who testified to seeing Jesus after his death and burial. Jews and Greeks, rich and poor, women and men, some who believed quickly, others who were skeptical at first, some who followed him during his life, and some who hated him during his life. And they didn't just see the empty tomb, is my point. They actually saw Jesus. And Jesus did not just appear to individuals. You also have 3 separate group appearances mentioned in the scriptures. The 12 disciples, all of the apostles, and then to 500 at one time. Plus, these appearances are not, ooh, we saw him standing on top of a building from a distance, or we saw him in a dream. No, we're talking about a man physically walking into a room, interacting with and talking with people, allowing them to touch his hands, and to people who had previously spent significant periods of their life following him. And so it's not like they could have been mistaken about his identity. And if you read the material, you'll see they come to believe God had raised Jesus from the dead, despite having every predisposition to the contrary. Because number 10, this would not have been something they just made up to prove Jesus' divinity or messiahship. First, now listen carefully here. In the Greco-Roman world, bodily resurrection was not a sign of being divine. It actually wasn't even part of their worldview. The Greeks understood that the physical body was the prison house of the soul, which was liberated at death. Plato actually said, and people believed, that the goal was to escape the horrors of a physical body. So if you're trying to claim that Jesus is God, bodily resurrection is not the way to do it. A return to a physical body would be a sign that somebody was not God. And it's the same in the Jewish world, where there are in fact 0 traditions or predictions in Jewish history and literature about a Messiah being raised to life into a new physical body in the middle of history. It was not something within the Jewish world of thinking. And that's important because if you're trying to sell the resurrection on the general public, it's not something you would make up to try to convince the Jewish world, because that in fact would be proof of nothing. And on this point, I would just say, please read the writing of N.T. Wright, William Lane Craig, Mike Lincona. Number 11, remember we're after inference to the best explanation. Number 11, if this were made up, the writers of Scripture would likely have explained how the resurrection fulfilled the Scriptures. But they don't. For everything else in Jesus' life, his 3.5 years of public ministry, you get all kinds of biblical references. Jesus did this according to the scriptures. Jesus did that just as the scriptures foretold. He did this like Moses, that like David, this like Adam, only he's a new Moses, a new David, a new Adam. So why not say he was resurrected according to the scriptures? But they don't. The actual account of the resurrection is just vacant of scriptural support. And I'm just saying, if you're going to make something up, something you know is false, you would probably include how it fulfilled the scriptures when you told the stories like you did with everything else, but the disciples don't. Now, later Paul will explain how Jesus' death and resurrection happened precisely according to the scriptures, but you have none of that in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Number 12, the early disciples of Jesus, they suffer and they endure martyrdom for their beliefs. Against torture and the most horrible form of death, they stuck to their story. And just for me, this is evidence that they were trying to tell it like it was, that they sincerely believed it. And now number 13, and this is the last one for today. Remember, we're after inference to the best explanation. Number 13, spooky stuff, confusing stuff, does happen. I'm saying that this resurrection story is not the only experience in history that cannot be explained by science. Please, on this one point, read from the work of Dale Allison. He's a professor at Princeton and esteemed New Testament scholar who is very objective and very credible. His newest book is called Encountering Mystery, Religious Experience in a Secular Age. But then, even more, he's got another book, the resurrection of Jesus, apologetics, polemics, and history, in which he makes the most powerful negative case that I've ever read concerning the resurrection of Jesus. It is extraordinary, and he is sincerely and extremely skeptical, but he still comes in the end to affirm definite death, definite burial, definite empty tomb, and undeniable claims for the postmortem appearances. You won't find anywhere a more critical and objective sifting of the evidence than in this book. But he comes down on the sign of probability based on inference to the best explanation. And I hope you'll see, TNC, much of our entire lives is making inferences to the best explanation for things, not just in history, but things generally. And of course, I hope today will lead you to your own further study, because mountains have been written about this, and you can watch hundreds of hours of conversations about this on YouTube. Just make sure you're reading peer-reviewed scholarship and listening to conversations from peer-reviewed scholars. And I'll just sort of end abruptly right here. I want to keep this podcast a manageable length. So let's pray together now. Will you pray with me? God, as we approach Easter and the celebration of the resurrection, give us confidence to explore this bit of history. And even more, give us confidence to live with humility and love and openness to the ongoing dialogue about what this means and what it might mean for our universe. God, I pray now for every person listening, for their families, their places of work, their hopes and their dreams, their discouragements and difficulties. We come to you seeking your wisdom and your peace. And so, TNC, I pray that the Lord would bless you and keep you, make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you, turn his face towards you and give you peace. Amen.